Joining me on the line is Rick Rule, chairman of Sprott USA. Mr. Rule is one of the most successful precious metals and natural resource equity investors of the past 30-odd years, and he's one of our favorite people to talk to on the space. Rick, thank you for being here.
Tommy, thanks for the opportunity.
So tell me, what are your thoughts on where we are in the mining cycle right now?
My gut feeling is, and I think knowing you, that the question probably resolves around the junior markets.
Sure.
My suspicion is that the market has really begun to bifurcate, which is a topic that we talked about the last time you and I visited.
That's right.
By bifurcation, I mean that my suspicion is that the best part of the junior market has already bottomed and is headed up. I don't think it's going to feel like the market is headed up, because when I say the best part, I mean the best 10 or 15% of the companies on the exchange. Mostly, you know, your readers need to understand that the junior markets taken as a whole are valueless. And 60 or 70% of the companies on the exchange are going to continue, I think, towards, you know, inexorably towards their intrinsic value, which is zero. And so it's going to feel like a bear market for another 18 to 24 months, which will cause people to be dispirited, even though some parts of the market are responding well. I think the period of time that we're in right now corresponds very directly to 1992 and also 2000, which were, I think, similar inflection points in the market, pardon me, where many investors continue to experience another couple years of extremely poor performance, but where experienced investors that had access to good geological and engineering knowledge really began to make some pretty serious money. So I'm extremely encouraged by what I see.
I see I know the bifurcation that you're speaking of. You can see a lot of these better development stage companies have seemed to bottomed and have climbed some 20%, some more. I think Ivanhoe might be up 60 or 70% from its summer bottoms now. But where does that leave the exploration sector? Because it doesn't seem like the bifurcation of the best quality exploration stories has happened. I don't see much money flowing into that sector. What are your thoughts on the really early stage companies at this point?
Well, I have two comments with regards to that, really three. First of all, the prospect generators have held up reasonably well, I guess because they don't need to come back to market for more equity. And that's a sector that we have always paid particular attention to. The second comment I would have is that exploration companies that deliver some performance have done really well. You know, look in the Australian market as an example at Sirius Resources, which is up 20-fold in 2 years. That's a fairly good return. Reservoir Minerals would be an example. Africa Oil would be a third example. The idea that a market fails because it doesn't give capital on advantageous terms to people who waste it is a criticism. What this market has been starved for is performance, and those companies that performed have been rewarded. The fact is that the exploration industry was stupidly overcapitalized in the period 2003 to 2010. And at least in my experience, every truly great party causes a truly monumental hangover. And we're in that phase now. I think the third thing is that the junior exploration industry needs to look at its own cost structure. The fact is that across the length and breadth of the junior exploration industry, our own studies have indicated that substantially more than half the capital raised in the 2003 to 2007 timeframe for over half the companies in the industry went to general and administrative expenditures. And the idea that institutional and retail investors have decided to go on strike with regards to funding ineffective lifestyle exercises disguised as public companies is, I think, a very, very, very healthy development. We went through these capital droughts in the early 1990s, and we went through these capital droughts in the 1998 to 2003 period. And your readers need to remember that bear markets such as this are the authors of bull markets. And bull markets, such as the one we went through in the 2003 to 2010 time frame, are authors of bear markets. This is a natural, normal, and extremely healthy cycle. Whether or not your readers have the discipline to make money from it is a different question. But in the context of the market that we're in now, truly your greatest risk is yourself.
What do you mean your greatest risk is yourself? Just sticking with names that are underperforming or selling?
Well, very, very, very high quality. The truth is that investors get excited in very good markets and lose at least half their money when the water goes over the edge. You know, when the stocks go over the edge. And investors get very depressed in very cheap markets. The idea that somebody would be more excited about a company at $2 than they are about it at 20 cents when it has the same range of assets 3 years later is pretty silly on the face of it.
Sure, but everybody's embarrassed to show face when they've lost money on paper, and it's just hard to be fired up about it, you know?
Well, for the record, Tommy, junior capital markets may be closed, but Sprott is not. We are aggressively trying to allocate capital in this market. We're having a disconnect between our willingness to write checks and the issuers, the terms that the issuers are willing to accept. My suspicion is that the issuers' price expectations were set in the 2003 to 2010 bull market. And my suspicion is that the issuers believe that those were normalized as opposed to optimal conditions. With regards to ourselves at Sprott, we are eagerly trying to participate in financing the junior exploration sector all the way down to very, very, very small companies. It's really a function of price and terms.
So you're the powder at Sprott is there's still some dry powder around?
Lots of dry powder.
Tell me about the institutional fund flows that you must see in your position. Like, has there been any signals that sentiment is changing or that flows are starting to come back into commodities businesses?
We aren't seeing capital from the traditional sources. We are seeing lots of interest in our proprietary non-public products. You may have seen that we very recently initiated a joint venture with Zijin Mining of China, which will see Zijin and ourselves invest for our own account and on behalf of several large Chinese institutional investors who hitherto have not been participants in the Western junior markets. In addition, our private credit business, which does bridge and mezzanine finance for natural resource issuers, has seen very, very, very strong interest from non-traditional private investors on a global basis. The flow of funds in our publicly traded mutual funds has begun to recover, albeit from an extremely low base, given our historical standards. With regards to asset accumulation in the brokerage business in the United States, that's been strongly positive for the last 6 months. So I suspect among high-income, high-net-worth individual investors that there's strong attraction to the sector.
So what do you think will prompt some of the world's big funds to get back into the gold business, particularly the more senior names first, because I imagine that's kind of where the cycle rejuvenates, starting from the big caps on down. What do you think are the catalysts to prompt those investors to get back into the sector?
Well, I think with regards to the very, very large cap names, particularly names like Xstrata, BHP, and Rio, that the recovery over the next 2 years will occur simply as a consequence of them on an enterprise value to EBITDA basis being too cheap. And I think they're cheap enough that they will attract value and generalist funds. And I think increasingly you're seeing an interest in the superannuation and insurance sectors matching very long-term liabilities, retirement liabilities, to the very long-term stable cash flows and the potentially inflation-adjusted cash flows that you see among the senior miners. I think that transition is beginning to occur now, albeit, again, from very low levels. In terms of the large generalist funds coming back into the junior space, I don't think that'll happen for a long time, and I think that's a very good thing. I think there's a difference between the capital needs of the junior sector and the investment capabilities of the large generalist funds. I don't think that they should have been in this market, and I think that they did themselves enough damage that they won't return easily. I think this is a space for much more specialized investors. I think there's room in this industry for private equity investors. I think there's a lot of room in this industry for top-down consolidation and lateral consolidation once we, you know, get rid of managers that are involved in the thing as sort of salary maximization schemes. So I think that we're going to have to look towards non-traditional sources of capital in the sector, which, once the recovery gets underway, which I think it will be in the sort of 18 to 24 month time frame, I think will be available in spades. I mean, certainly I know from the viewpoint of Sprott and a couple competitors in North America, in particular Dundee and Liberty Mutual, there isn't a shortage of capital available. We all have lots of capital, and we have all expressed a willingness to write checks. What is absent is a willingness on the part of the issuers to take the capital on terms that are reflective of the valuations that everybody sees in their equity prices.
Well, you know, I read this morning that that there were obviously predictions of some 800 or 1,000 junior companies would be delisted from the TSX, and it turns out it's only been something like 16 or 20 over the last year. So that's not happening.
That's amazing.
And the management teams obviously believe their own BS as much as ever. So anyway, this shakeout hasn't happened yet, which makes me sort of feel like, you know, bifurcation continues, and you know, the majority of junior mining companies in Canada are going to continue to sort of swirl around the toilet bowl for another little while, and it's good to hear some other perspectives like yours.
Well, certainly, there's a lot of things, if you will, going on below the surface that are good. An example would be, Ned Goodman's recent involvement in an alternative exchange, which would lower the regulatory and listing fees for the junior sector. You know, that attack at costs, I think, is a very good thing. And I continue to believe, personally, that purging the exchange of 600 or 800 names would be a wonderful thing. I think that having 100 or 200 or 300 JCPs or shells expire would be a very good thing. The industry is and was substantially overcapitalized, and we really can't move forward until we've exercised all of the sins that we accumulated in the 2003 to 2010 timeframe.
So it makes it hard to look at the sector and you know, to a retail guy to say I want to come back and place some bets, because he has a hard time distinguishing between the filet mignon companies and you know, the others. But
I think that's true, but you know, it's not supposed to be easy, Tommy.
Well, fair enough, but from the standpoint of where these equities are now, like Ivanhoe Mines 260, Reservoir Minerals, I think it's like, you know, it's 480, or I don't even know the last quote, but like you, Fission at 550, these higher quality sort of discovery names that are now in development, do you think that, you know, that they're going to have upside in this period, or do we sort of need to wait for the cleansing for these higher quality companies to be rewarded? What's your thought on that?
I think it depends on the name. With regards to Reservoir Minerals as an example, I think the market's very amenable to taking them higher. But, you know, the run from 26 cents to $4 has been a pretty good run. And they need to be able to continue to deliver news. Let me leave it there. Ivanhoe, of course, is a very special situation. You have a guy who I believe is probably the most successful exploration and development entrepreneur of several generations, and it would appear that he has made two sort of generational discoveries which are in one vehicle. The market knock, of course, is that these discoveries are in South Africa and Congo, which are respectively troubled and dysfunctional countries, and that there is risk associated with financing. My own experience has been that superb projects finance themselves, including in difficult countries. I remember the crisis in confidence that I had myself owning large amounts of Tanki mining in the mid-90s in Congo, when the conditions in the Congo were much worse than they were today. And the truth was that the quality of that deposit won out. It got financed, and that was a 20 or 25 cent stock that got taken out at, I don't know, $16 or $17. I'm not suggesting that the same upside exists in Ivanhoe, but I've never seen that range of assets in one junior company before. So I understand the problem that you're suggesting, and I'm not dancing around it. What I would suggest is that serious investors understand that a recovery in the market may take 2 years or 3 years, but I suspect in that 2 or 3 year period, very much like the 2000 to 2003 time frame, that there will be literally scores of five baggers and a reasonable number of 10-baggers. What many retail investors want, of course, is something to happen in a quarter. And unfortunately, most retail investors make the mistake of thinking that what they want matters. But it doesn't. What matters is what is, and how you deal with the opportunities available, and how you manage your own perceptions and prejudices.
Okay, so let's talk about a few other names. Like I mentioned Fission, which is obviously, had a huge run. You are an owner, you've mentioned in past interviews. I don't know if you still are, but once a discovery is sort of matured, do you try to jump off and then wait for them to develop the resource and permit it, or do you stay on at that point?
I'm not smart enough to jump off. I have two comments on Fission. I think it's being held down, realistically, by troubles in the uranium market. And I expect the spot price of uranium to double, but I'm happy to think that it might be 3 years or 4 years. When you think about things rationally, a three-year double or a four-year double, if it's a probability, is not a bad thing. With specific regards to Fission, I am very attracted to what they're doing in an exploration sense. I think that their exploration has begun to be predictive, meaning that they understand the nature of the discovery well enough that the pace of exploration success will increase. My current intention with regards to Fission, which is a fairly large position, is that unless I'm wrong and the exploration becomes less predictive, that I'll own the name until it has a different symbol.
That's a strong endorsement, I'm sure. Mr. Randall will be happy with that. It should be if you look at some peers, but then again, what do we know? What do I know? I've still got you. Obviously, it'd be great to have your comment on the Pretium Strathcona Snowden dispute. I know you're a big fan of Bob Quartermain's. What do you see there happening? You still own your stock, and what's the comment?
I'm a huge friend of Bob's, and I don't own the stock, but not as a consequence of the most recent dispute. I stopped owning the stock because Bob delivered share market performance that exceeded every possible level of greed that I had. I was a very large buyer on the initial public offering, and in the market that we have experienced in the last 3 years, a move from $6 to $18, particularly with the volumes that were available, was extraordinary. It has been, for the last 4 or 5 months, my belief with regards to Pretium that we were in a market that wanted to go down. And in the near term, Bob was sort of stuck in a conundrum where if the news that came out of the bulk study was bad, the stock would go up. But pardon me, would go down. And if the news that came out of the bulk study was good, that the stock would trade sideways. So it has been my belief that the right thing to do in terms of reestablishing that position would be, rather than anticipate the results of the bulk study, which is unnecessary, that one can react to the bulk study. I think that that strategy is particularly efficacious now, because, and I guess I'm a belief, I'm a minority in this, I believe that the results of the bulk sample will be good. And I believe that when those results are published, the professional disputes associated with the nature of the bulk study will cause people to discount the results of the study, and that those results will be the subject of discussions within the industry for 3 or 4 months. If the results are as I anticipate them, and if the reaction to the results are stilted by some academic discussion of Krieging, I'll be an extraordinarily large buyer. I have known Bob Quartermain for 2 decades, and to suggest that he is either dishonest or incompetent is, I mean, a monumental stupidity. And if I have the ability to buy Bob Quartermain and, you know, sort of a 12-gram average over 10,000 tons, I am likely to be on that stock like white on rice.
Well, that's good to know. Are there any other names that you've been buying?
Well, I guess one that I could talk about is Uranium Participation Corp. They're having a hard time finding a bid because the punters are very uncomfortable with the fact that they may have to wait 3 years to get a double. Given the market that we've experienced in the last 3 years, the idea that a probable 3 or 4 year double is somehow viewed as insufficient return is a mystery to me. I'm sort of attracted to results like that. And that's one where we've probably bought enough, although we will continue to buy on dips, that I don't mind talking about it. The other reason I don't mind talking about it is most punters will find it boring, and they'll look at my remarks and say, oh, well, a 4 year double, I want something that's going to triple by Christmas, you know.
And for that, you got to open up an account at Sprott Global, right?
That would be lovely. That would be lovely.
Last question. I know you're an oil and gas man originally. What are your thoughts on the, sort of like the sluggish performance of the Canadian domiciled gas names, oil and gas names, versus some of the American valuations, which are obviously going different ways right now?
I think the American valuations are excessive. I think that the American small cap and mid cap producer has been too aggressive with regards to leverage. I think the Canadians have been much more prudent. I don't know if that's because the Canadian banks have been more prudent. I think that the sub 5,000 barrel a day producer segment in Canada has some outstanding value. And, I think you need to look at the sector differently. The game in Canada used to be to build yourself to 3,000 or 4,000 barrels and sell yourself to an income trust. Of course, they're gone. But I think if the valuation disparity between the United States and Canada doesn't change, that you will see American private equity players come into Calgary. And I think that rather than the private to public arbitrage, that there's going to be a public to private arbitrage. as the small cap Canadian producers get taken private. I think the values are exceptional. I shouldn't say that. I think some of the valuations are exceptional.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to ask about how much oil and gas business versus mining Sprott does, but finish your point. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, we're certainly overwhelmingly regarded in the market as a mining and precious metals-oriented firm. We have, for some years, had a fairly good energy practice, and of course we expanded that energy practice pretty aggressively 18 months ago, acquiring the Toscana group of companies in Calgary, who we had known and in fact competed with for two decades. Given that the Toscana people are now partners of ours as opposed to competitors of ours, we've been able to increase the size of our footprint in Calgary, and we're no longer suitcase bankers or suitcase investors, people who drop in respectively from California or Toronto. We have a good local Calgary presence, and we expect that the energy business will grow within Sprott, even relative to the mining business, which we think will grow as well. Really is a function of the fact that we have an extremely high-quality team in Calgary, and we think the part of the market that we serve in terms of both the provision of debt and equity, the sub-5,000-barrel-a-day space, is very, very, very attractively priced. We see a sort of a $3.5 billion need in Calgary among small cap companies drilling off resource plays, and we would love to play a role, an increasing role, helping those companies with equity, with off-balance sheet finance, with drilling joint ventures, with bridge and mezzanine finance, with acquisition debt finance. We see a myriad of opportunity for Sprott in Calgary.
And Sprott's your largest position still, I'm assuming?
Personally?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so you've got to put all your money on one stock at Sprott, Inc.?
Well, it's nice to own a piece of where you show up to work. I'm delighted to have the opportunity at this point in my career to work with Eric Sprott, who's been a mentor of mine for two decades. And I'm delighted to work with the team that we have assembled at Sprott. I'm happy about our competitive position. You know, in the financial services business, the new norm is people trying to operate billion-dollar balance sheets with $80 million in equity. At Sprott, we eat our own cooking. We're sort of an anti-financial services firm in that we have no debt and $300-something million in working capital. And I'm very, very, very comfortable with our balance sheet. I'm very, very, very comfortable with our team. It's a really exciting time to be working at Sprott, and it's a really exciting time to be an owner of Sprott. Eric pointed out to me on the phone 3 weeks ago that between the Canadian operations of Sprott and the U.S. operations of Sprott, if you look back over 30 years, we've grown the size of this business 100-fold, really through the aggressive deployment of capital in markets like this. I mean, this is the sort of time, looking back to the early 90s and the 1998 to 2003 market, that the real dramatic growth in Sprott profitability and net asset value per share have taken place. And we think we're really uniquely positioned in terms of the market's perception of the brand. Sprott is very well known globally. In terms of the depth of human resources that we have, we've hired all the way through the downturn. And in particular, the strength of our own balance sheet and our product offerings, both to investors and to the extractive industry community, we see ourselves very, very, very well positioned to take advantage of the rest of this bear market cycle and, of course, the bull market that will inevitably follow this bear market.
You have any last word on gold or miners or anything else that we didn't touch on?
No, I think just a reiteration of the obvious, which is that bear markets are the authors of bull markets, and bull markets are the authors of bear markets. Your listeners and readers who are discouraged need to remember that they've suffered through 2.5 or 3 years of a bear market, and bull markets inevitably follow. Having lived through the pain, you may as well hang around for the gain. I would suggest also that investors realize in bull markets and bear markets that the biggest risk that they ever face is to the left of their right ear and to the right of their left ear. And managing that risk will put every other risk in context.
Well, thank you very much for your perspectives today, Rick. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk to your audience.
All right, I'll be in touch with you soon. Thank you very much.
Great. Cheers. Thank you.